Welcome to Discovery and Inspiration, a podcast from the National Humanities Center. I'm Robert Newman, President and Director of the Center, and your host for this episode. In March of 1850, five men and two women were photographed in the studio of South Carolina artist Joseph Zealy. When these daguerreotypes were uncovered in 1976, they quickly became some of the best-known pre-Civil War images of enslaved African Americans. Yet the fact that so little is known about the subjects of these photographs should prompt us to ask important questions about why these images were captured, how they were lost for so long, and what they might tell us about legacies of white supremacy and enslavement in the United States. Our guest today is Greg Hekimovich, professor of English at Furman University, where his research focuses on African American literature, history, and biography. This year, as a fellow at the center, he has been working on a new book tentatively titled The Columbia Seven, The Life and Times of the Zealy Daguerreotypes. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you so much, Robert. Great to be here.
So your project is really fascinating because it combines many different genres of inquiry. You're engaging elements of visual studies, history, and biography to animate your project, and your own training and background is in English literature. Can you tell us how these different genres and methodologies come together in your current work on the Zealy daguerreotypes?
Oh, fascinating question, Robert. Thank you so much. The different genres really come together in the archive. So it becomes a quest in what is left in the reachable archive to recover the history behind those photographs. So the different genres that intermingle come out of what is recoverable. And what is recoverable first are the daguerreotypes themselves that were discovered in 1976, as you said, and they're preserved at the Peabody Museum at Harvard University, and you can go and see these daguerreotypes, and they're extraordinarily powerful. Daguerreotype is a unique photographic object. When you look at a daguerreotype, the image is almost multidimensional. It's in relief from the background of the plate in which it was produced through chemicals. So it's an extraordinary experience to see these figures and that object itself. So as you're saying, the first genre there is a visual genre. Then there is a written genre, because in those daguerreotype cases, a handwritten note, like almost like on a sticky note, Robert W. Gibbs, a physician who helped Louis Agassiz, the Harvard professor seeking these photographs, wrote notes for each figure, and that's how we know their names and how to locate them. So you have a textual artifact along with a visual artifact. Then you have the material history of daguerreotype making. You have in that object Joseph T. Zealy's name as part of the object itself. So you enter another dimension, which is going to be the sort of history behind where these photographs were produced. And it says in the photographs in two different places, one on the daguerreotype case and one within the notes that Robert W. Gibbs left, that these were produced in Columbia, South Carolina. And so now you've gone visual, you've gone textual, and now you enter the world of history. And the first thing you do is you get in your car and you go to the archives that are the closest place to understanding the genesis of those photos. So it is a multi-genre element, but it comes from the objects itself. It's not, at least in my case, I didn't train specifically in visual arts and then apply it to a discipline. I'm really following and learning along the way out of the material objects that I'm listening to find the story behind those objects.
These photographs are just such a striking catalyst for your project. Talk about how you first encountered them. How did you first encounter them? And what was your initial reaction when you did?
It's so vivid to me. It's one of those moments that something calls to you in an intellectual quest, and you just know it's going to draw you into its world. And it was in 2014, I was a fellow at the Hutchins Center at Harvard University, and I was working on my earlier biography, which took many, many years to finish, on The Life and Times of Hannah Crafts. And I gave a presentation at Harvard about the research behind discovering Hannah Bond's identity and the deep archival work and the years of piecing together contextual clues to tell that story. And in the audience that day was Lisa Barbash, who is the head of the curation department that oversees the daguerreotypes. And she came up afterwards and we talked a little bit. And she told me about the daguerreotypes, which I didn't know about at the time. And I immediately was just compelled. And she said, well, if you want to see him, I can have a showing for you. And I set up an appointment. I went to her office. I saw those daguerreotypes, and they floored me. They're powerful. And in some respect, of course, it's demeaning that these figures are forced to have these photographs taken. But there's a type of human character and spirit that just still radiates from the particular object. And I was fascinated, as I was in earlier projects, who are these people? What were their lives like? I really decided I wanted to make that my next major research subject. Lisa invited me in. A group of Harvard scholars were working on a project for a big book. Really wonderful, amazing scholars. I got to work with Deb Willis, who's one of the great historians of the visual arts, and a whole other array of wonderful people. And Lisa just saw in me a type of deep archival sleuthing that I've been doing for many years working on my earlier project. And she said, if you can write the biography chapter, we really need that as part of the project. So for years, I was able to work with this great group of scholars and put in, I think by the time I finished the piece that was a part of it, it was 6 or 7 years of archival work, piecing together the story for each of those figures, which is what I continue to do in the book that I'm completing now here at the National Humanities Center this year.
So you're creating, at least part of the project, is creating a kind of ensemble biography. And, you know, I think our general audience is probably more used to encountering biographies of a singular individual. So talk to us a little bit about the challenges of doing an ensemble biography.
Yeah, the ensemble biography is interesting because, and in some ways, it's the object again, and the history that you're trying to tell determines the form. So if there was a full story complete unto itself that could be discovered about one important figure, the figure Delia is probably the most famous of the seven photographs, then, you know, perhaps I would write a biography of Delia, but it's impossible to find a full life story. So just naturally, again, the forms of the objects and what's recoverable invites a really contextual approach. And that contextual approach is what brought these seven figures together to be photographed in 1850 by Joseph T. Zealy. And in a way, it's exciting because an ensemble biography transcends the life of a single person. That person is necessarily placed in an even deeper context. And I think as a researcher and a scholar, there's a deeper story sometimes in ensemble biography that is harder to frame and reach in a singular biography. But like the other projects, The Life and Times of Hannah Crafts, I ended up writing that as a kind of an ensemble biography. So we enter the lives of the other enslaved people that author knew and how she used those people as part of her novel. So it's just a model that I'm comfortable with. But in every case, including the daguerreotypes, the daguerreotypes are inviting an ensemble approach. And even the fact that those objects were stacked together in a cabinet in the attic of the Peabody Museum and then opened in 1976, their representation to the world was ensemble. And so the approach to writing the story and life and times of those just naturally seems to be an ensemble biography approach.
So the project also kind of, you know, leans into a broader conversation about how do we value stolen lives from the past? And it's a conversation, a broader conversation about memory and also reparations. I wonder if you can comment on how this project contributes to that broader conversation.
It is a question of repair. So the objects themselves are these lives of these seven unique people who history had forgotten. White people's history had tried to use them. Louis Agassiz, who had these photographs taken, was an important scientist at Harvard, and he was a deep believer in the inferiority of people of darker skin. And he had these photographs produced as scientific specimens, like he did when he had illustrated birds and horses, and he was describing the natural world as a typology. And that typology he was forcing onto them, an inferior position for those seven figures. The repair of that, of course, is the history of African Americans and the contributions and the outstanding art and outstanding works that they produce. So the repair that I'm trying to do in this project is to get at the spirits behind those figures that you can see if you go see those photographs. They still feel very much alive when you open them and look at the dance of the forms behind on those copper plates. So the repair is recapturing what their lives were really like. What were the joys? What were the pleasures? What were their descendants? And the repair is recapturing the life and times of those figures, what they produced. Jem is one of the figures who's photographed. He was an extraordinarily talented engineer, construction director. I'm able to find in account books of his possessor, the sort of works that he did. He built racetracks. He helped build bridges. He helped build churches in Colombia. And then the repair is to find out, well, who were his descendants? And I've been working on that. So I've been able to find Jem's descendants who ended up possessing a construction company after the Civil War that eventually they moved to Charleston, South Carolina. I was able to find out who Jem's wife was. They were married while they were enslaved and then recreated their family after slavery. So the repair is there in our history, but it's a history that was erased, that was hidden away in an attic for almost a century. And it was a shame. It was out of shame, but also control that white historians, white scientists tried to damage or destroy this history or have it not told. But it's like the ghosts in the attics come out. And that history, I think people in the United States are very interested in now because it's a fuller history that we have. And there's political contention around all that. But the real history always wins. If you're interested in the truth sometimes is in the attic. And the ghosts that we tease out of a history that helps shape our world, to do that work is to understand our world much more fully. And I think these daguerreotypes and their own role in the question of reparations is profound. It's why I think this project, for me, is worth, I'm sure, like my other project, this will be a decade, over a decade of really intensive work that I've put into it. And it's a joy and a pleasure to do that because it's an important history that otherwise is being dissembled or hidden or lost. So the repair is the other side of the story, the full story of our history that these daguerreotypes really tell. These were laborers who made extraordinary contributions, and they're representative of the millions of enslaved people who produced the wealth and capital that catapulted America into its own power years and years after the Civil War. So what was the source of all that? We can study it statistically and so forth, but as an ensemble biographer, telling this story not just around capital and tables of wealth and products that were moved, but telling it through the lives of these seven figures just feels important addition to what we can know of our past and how we can understand our future.
So by telling the stories of the subjects of these photographs, you're calling attention to the forms of white supremacy and enslavement that are responsible for obscuring them. But these forces also tend to make traditional forms of archival research more complicated. Could you tell us about some of the specific challenges that you faced or are facing as you undertake or undertook historical, regional, and genealogical research for the project?
Yeah, thanks, Robert. It's a really interesting question. And there's so many great scholars, African-American scholars, who have blazed the trail on this and who I'm just in the back ranks of the Army doing this similar sort of work. And that is recovering the history, the Black Archive. What that means is so many of the papers that the states, that the federal government, that researchers eventually assembled in special collections were produced and preserved because they were possessed by the powerful white people who held the levers of power. And so what gets placed in or focused on in those archives usually leaves out the lives of the people who were dispossessed, who were controlled in some fashion. And so it's a very uneven world when you enter officially sanctioned archive. Now, to recover the Black Archive, and this is what so many wonderful African-American scholars have taught us over the last 20 years, and it's the hottest place in the Academy right now with some of the most groundbreaking work led by people like Blair Kelly, who's here this year with me, Tricia Matthew, Rhonda Thomas, who's at Clemson, Pete Gabriel Foreman, Christina Sharp. These are the real knowledge boundary pushers in the humanities right now. And what they're doing is recovering this history that's not just in the Southern Historical Collection. I mean, there's fragments and shards there that you can find that earlier white historians didn't want to pay attention to, and that's a good place to start. But the other place you have to go is into the communities. You have to go to the towns. You have to go to the local historic commissions. You have to go into the courthouses and into private genealogies, and you have to interview people in African-American communities. You have to engage the African-American churches that preserve a lot of this history. So you have to go to the sources that still hold this history if you're going to be able to return it to an archive that's a book that you might be writing, an archive that is the personal archive that each one of these scholars I'm talking about are producing themselves and will leave to posterity for future researchers. So it's kind of, you're writing this history, but you're also an archivist building these archives. I'm really excited. This summer I'm leading an NEH seminar with colleagues at Clemson that brings 26 people from all over the country, largely African-American people, because they were really interested in our subject, which is building the African-American archive, the Black Archive. We'll spend 3 weeks bringing experts in, talking about what I was just explaining. How do you get to these specific non-sanctioned archives? And what are the practical ways that you do it? Everyone involved in this, we're not theorizing it. I mean, that's important, but what we're doing is practicing. What did you do to get to these stories? And I know for me, a lot of times it's finding in these small communities the local history teacher who is known in the community, not known by among academics, but known in the community to possess the history of that smaller region, and opening up these different areas of knowledge that haven't been sanctioned, that have been occluded, that have been left out. So that institute that we're doing for the NEH is part of a larger movement, I think, and the humanities, recovering and balancing a fuller history so that we really know what we're facing. If a legislator is going to ask, are you teaching critical race theory? Well, the answer is, well, what do you mean by critical race theory? And then if they reply with some bat crazy idea, you're like, no, we're not teaching that. We're teaching history. So there's a politicization to this that is, I think, easy to just avoid, because it's smoke and mirrors. It's not the work that serious people who are trying to create new knowledge and possess what we lost in our past they're not engaged in whatever craziness that sort of perspective can perceive or project on it.
So finally, and you've already talked about this some, could you generally briefly encapsulate for our audience, what is the impact that you hope to achieve, not just for fellow historians, but why should people care? What's important about this project in terms of the advancement of knowledge?
Well, I think specifically we have 7 daguerreotypes that are in the possession of the Peabody Museum at Harvard University. Those 7 daguerreotypes were produced as objects to advance conception of white supremacy. They were hidden away for the same purposes. They were discovered in 1976, and only until recently have they become the subject of deep study. And the other colleagues that are a part of the earlier project to make their own way in the world assembled art historians, leading visual art historians, literary scholars, to investigate all the different aspects of the daguerreotypes. That's one important book. But what I want to do is to really return specifically to those seven individuals and understand their stories and trace the descendant communities that they gave rise to. And I've been able to do that. That's the work that I've been doing this year. Ultimately, what matters is what happens to those seven objects. Harvard doesn't want to continue possessing them. They understand the history of white supremacy for which that university, like many universities, has been complicit. Where do those objects go? Well, where they go is related to who those people are. And what my work is attempting to do is find the descendants, discuss where they believe those photographs should go, and find a more proper home for those seven people. And to find a more proper home for those seven people is to understand the full story of why those objects were made, who those people are, and who their descendants are. My project attempts to do that, and it's just a very vivid example of what repair or reparations could look like.
Thank you, Professor Greg Hekimovich, and thank you to everyone who has joined us for this discussion. I'm Robert Newman. Please tune in for the next episode of Discovery and Inspiration from the National Humanities Center.